Okay, guys, how's things? Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. I am not the most professional broadcaster in the world, but I'm good on everything. So, this is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm here weekdays from noon to 2 Eastern Time on the Liberty Radio Network. Sunday mornings, I'm on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, the Pacifica station there in Los Angeles, for my show Anti-War Radio, still called that, the Sunday show is. And I keep all my stuff at scotthorton.org, including all my interview archives, 3,600 and more, going back to 2003. And then you can find also the articles I've written, documentaries I'd have you look at if you have the time and want to watch a cool documentary. I got a bunch of ones for you. And there's a chat room. If you want to join up the chat room during the show, it's scotthorton.org/chat. And you don't need any kind of external application or anything. Just go there in your browser window, fake name and a CAPTCHA, and you're in. It's an IRC free node chat if you're into that kind of thing and you do have a external application you like to use for that. Well, then go ahead, IRC free node chat, hashtag Scott Horton Show. See you in there. Got three good interviews lined up for you today. Michael Schwartz is going to be on to talk about the Israelis stealing the Palestinians' natural gas, as they are so often want to do with, well, whatever it is that the Palestinians own that they want. And David Hardy is going to be on the show to talk about the Waco massacre, that time that Bill Clinton sent the Army Delta Force to murder the Branch Davidians. Janet Reno is guilty of sending the FBI to murder them, but only Bill could have sent the Combat Applications Group Delta Squadron, or whatever it is, B Squad, Stephen Barry said, right? Squadron B, or whatever. Yeah. I got the clip, god dang, I'll play the clip if I got to, I don't care. Yeah. So, David Hardy's going to be on because Mike McNulty has died. And so, you know, I value that guy's work highly enough that I'd like to take the opportunity of his death to remind people of what it was that he proved. I don't know if it was the most important thing in his life to him, but it's certainly a great contribution to, well, just journalism in America. And so David Hardy really helped him with his work, much more than I guess I had previously understood. And I think I've spoken with David Hardy before about Waco, actually, now that I think about it. But anyway, so he was really kind of partners with McNulty on, I guess, the second film, anyway. So we're going to have David Hardy on to talk about Mike McNulty and to talk about his Waco documentaries that he made, the first of which was nominated for an Academy Award. I don't know who beat it out. I do know why. And then Giraldi's going to be on the show, our friend Phil Giraldi, former CIA officer, yes, but good person, straight shooter. Read what he writes and hear what he says. I think you'll agree. In some ways, being a former CIA guy is an asset, right? People got to listen to him. Former CIA officer says this terror war is a bunch of nonsense. Hey, all right. But then former CIA officer says anything, on the other hand, is also kind of suspect. Who's he speaking for? What's his agenda? I think pay a little bit of attention to Giraldi in a row, and you'll know he's an honest guy and is saying exactly what he thinks for his own reasons, and that's it. So he'll be on the show to criticize Israel, of course, to criticize the Americans who go along with the Israelis in Washington, D.C. So that'll be fun. Got some Iran talks going on. And so forth. So that'll be good. But now, man, I got a lot of news to cover that I'm not going to be able to fit into their parts of the show today. So let me tell you that Jeff Tucker and I have a new show. It debuted a premiere or whatever the hell on Tuesday night. It's called Eye on the Empire. It's a video kind of format sort of thing there on liberty.me. And you can find it there if you sign up for liberty.me. It's just $4 if you use the promo code Scott Well, you get a month free, I guess, anyway, and then it's $4 a month after that, but there's no ads. So that's nice. And it's kind of a libertarian Facebook, only with quite a bit more going on. And I quit Facebook. I'm happy to be gone from Facebook. So, and it seems like liberty.me is catching on. More and more people sign up all the time. So sign up for liberty.me. Add me as a friend on there and check out the archive of Jeff Tucker and I's new show. The first episode has aired and is available there at liberty.me. Also, on March the 6th, I'm going to give a speech that I'm going to hopefully come up with tomorrow. And I think, you know what, it'll be the same old thing for you guys who are regular listeners to the show. It'll be me explaining why the terror war is all America's fault and why the only solution is to stop fighting it. That's all I have to say in this world, really. You know what? Just quit with the killing all the time. That's the thing. We don't need them. That's the thing. It's not about Islam. That's the thing. So, same old speech. I'm going to give one. It'll be March the 6th in Manchester, New Hampshire, at the Radisson Hotel there in Manchester, New Hampshire, at the New Hampshire Liberty Forum. And so, I know I'm on the radio in some places in New Hampshire, so come on out and see me if you guys are fans of the show, want to say hi. It's a whole giant thing, man. Speaking of Jeff Tucker, he's going to be giving a talk there, and dozens of libertarians are going to be giving talks on all kinds of subjects, and it's a hell of a project they have going on up there, the New Hampshire Liberty Forum. And so thanks for inviting me. I'll be there on the 6th of March to give a speech against the terror war. And yeah, so now on with the news. I think first I want to just get this out of the way. Hopefully I won't go on too long, and I'm almost out of time, so that should prevent me. First of all, I want to defend Ron Paul. Ron Paul said a thing that I doubt he even said, oh no, that didn't sound right or something when he said it, because he was so oblivious when he said it. He was talking about how he would work with the Congressional Black Caucus, that they were some of the only anti-war people in the House that he could count on to be anti-war. But then ultimately, really, what they wanted to do was save the war money for welfare. And so it wasn't, all he was saying was, they weren't that committed to being anti-war. They were that committed to welfare that it led them to be kind of anti-war. That's what he was trying to say. And if you listen, if you read the transcript at Salon.com, then you go, oh, Ron. But if you listen to what he said, there is not a black joke in there. He is not making some snide remark. He is not implying, oh yeah, that's a black thing, food stamps or some kind of crap like that. It's just not in there. You can listen to it yourself. It's just not in there. He's stating just his own anecdotal experience with these particular individuals, and he was not in any way playing into some stereotype or anything like that. If you take the words out of context, put them in print, and set it up with, oh, Ron Paul says something racist, then that sounds like something a racist person might say, but that's, of course, not what's going on there. But, of course, they don't care about that because they want to attack Rand Paul with anything controversial that Ron Paul says. There's another one of these today at BuzzFeed. They're making a big deal out of the fact that Ron Paul said that the guy that killed the sniper probably wouldn't have done it if he hadn't have been on a bunch of crazy psychotropic drugs. And that a lot of these suicides are from veterans who were going over there. And they quote at length from two different speeches where Ron Paul talked about this. And you know how Ron Paul kind of stumbles around like I do, and sort of he's all over the place a little bit, but you get through it and it's totally clear what he's saying is that we send these guys to these no-win wars. We set them at war with the population of the countries. We send them to occupy. And so then they come home and the people aren't even paying attention to the war. They're not even engaged in it. They've made the ultimate sacrifice, killed people, seen their best friends die next to them. And so they're wrecked. And then what do? We just fill their head full of pills when the solution is to stop sending them off to these wars. And they try to use that against Rand Paul. And so the lesson is Rand is up against everything. He should defend his father and fight. Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, guys. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, the Scott Horton Show. Let me see here. If I don't talk, how loud are those chainsaws in the background? Can you guys hear them, chat room? Oh, well, of course, then they stop using them the moment I say that. What is this, the mechanic? Well, anyway, you might hear some chainsaws in the background getting some work done at the house next door. So, oh, well. Just so you, in case you wonder what that buzzing sound is. You know, according to the little green bars, the microphone isn't even picking that up. Although it sure sounds like a pretty loud buzz in my ear. I don't know. Chat room guys? Chainsaws? No? Yes? Somebody tweet me. Somebody email me. And let me know. All right. So, Michael Schwartz, David Hardy, Phil Giraldi coming up on the show. You know, I never get to fit what I want to say into the segment there. Rand Paul, I might have missed him, but I don't think so. He's coming up at the CPAC conference that they're giving here. And you might have noticed that at BuzzFeed and I think a couple other places, they are parsing every word out of Ron Paul's mouth. And before this thing is over, because they're taking Rand Paul as a much more serious threat than Ron Paul. And before this thing goes too much further, they are going to attempt to dig up everything Ron Paul ever said and use it against Rand. Oh, yeah, Rand? Well, how do you answer for this? Oh, yeah, Rand? Well, how do you answer for that? And so far, his answer has been, hey, that's just my dad's opinion, and I'm my own man, and this and that kind of thing. But that's not really fair when Jeb Bush tries to say it, and it's not really fair when Rand Paul tries to say it. Or maybe it's fair or whatever, but it's not really unfair for people to ask him. What are the differences between you and your father? Whatever their bias is, I'm biased toward the father by a long shot, toward his point of view. But obviously the narrative in D.C. is that the father is crazy and that they can use him to beat Rand Paul over the head all day long. And Rand's strategy has been to move to the right, to sort of kind of and more or less disavow his father's view. But that only goes so far. Because, of course, the things where Ron Paul takes his heroic stands are the things that are the most important things in the whole wide world. Like Rand, can America afford a world empire? Or can it not? I don't want to hear about some bases. Okay? Full spectrum dominance, benevolent global hegemony, empire, or no, come home. Trade with all. Militarism for none. Well, your father always says all foreign aid is bad. Ultimately, it's transferring money from poor people in rich countries to rich people in poor countries. How's that fair? And propping up, you know, dictators in power and the rest of this. So far, Rand's answer has been, well, of course, continue paying the Israelis. Lying and denying he ever implied otherwise. But take it away from all those countries that we pay to pretend to like Israel, like Egypt. Well, how does that make any sense? The Israelis and their lobby denounced him for saying it anyway. Well, it doesn't make any sense. He's for him and against him at the same time. Which side do you think that they focus on? And so then the answer is, really here, is that Ron's not crazy. In fact, what the worst thing that Ron Paul ever had going for him is that sometimes he can be ineloquent in the way he gets a point across, especially, I think, in the second campaign, getting pretty tired out running a second presidential campaign there, and was not as good as he was back in 08. But Rand is still young. So in other words, if Rand just went ahead and said, you know what, my father's right about that, what are you, crazy? And took a stand on all these things, he could do a much better job, rhetorically speaking, I believe, at getting those points across than his father, at defending those positions. Not necessarily. I mean, because really what Ron really has going for him more than anything else is his blatant honesty. And Rand does not have that. He has a reputation as a flipper-flopper already. But you know what? That can change, though. If he would just be honest and say, are you kidding me? I'll take Ron Paul over John Bolton any day, okay? If John Bolton had his way, we'd be at war in Nigeria. We'd be at war in Libya. We'd be at war in Syria and in Iraq and in Afghanistan and forever. And I guess in Eastern Europe, too, against the Russians who are armed with H-bombs and ICBMs. But no, you know what? Back down. Move toward Bolton instead of just whooping his sorry ass. And here he is right now. And I don't know what he's going to say. It could be that he realizes that, you know what? He's got a real fight on his hands. They all are not going to accept him as more or less a conservative Republican presidential candidate. He has to defeat them. He has to lead the Republican Party against the rest of the leaders of his party on the most important issues. War and peace and related. So, I think Rand Paul, with his father's strategy, is not necessarily a winning combination because he ain't going to win anyway. But I think it's a much better way to handle this than, you know, continually selling out his father's correct points of view and statements, which makes him look bad anyway. And yet, what? Does he think he's ever going to win Jennifer Rubin over or something? I mean, come on. I don't know. Do the right thing, Rand. That's all I'm saying. Boy, let me move on here. I was going to say that real quickly, and now that was a whole damn segment, wasn't it? Look at the clock. Look at that clock. That was the whole damn segment. All right. Well, yeah, what the hell? Read my Twitter feed. You want the bad news. What can I tell you? Read Glenn Greenwald's new piece on America's support for Nazis in Ukraine. I'm glad he's decided to start writing about that issue. It's an important one. In fact, The Intercept has a great piece about the Chechen jihadists who are going to Ukraine to raise money and procure weapons to bring them back to try to fight another insurgency in Chechnya. Or maybe they're going to go on down to the Islamic State. They apparently have a lot of Chechens fighting for them there. Let's see. You can talk about all that with Bill. I guess I thought my time was up a minute ago. I was a minute off. I don't know what the hell I'm doing here. Oh, here's a good one. Fatal shooting in Texas again raises Mexico's ire over police killings. This is at McClatchy. I hadn't seen this one around on Twitter. It's in Grapevine, Texas. Guy gets out of his car with his hands up. The cop says, stop right there. He stops for a minute, but then he keeps walking toward the cop. Cop just shoots him dead. Didn't even claim he was reaching for his waistband or whatever stupid lie. And then the only reason it's news is because the Mexican government is complaining about it. And I guess what pissed me off the most is that McClatchy chose to use the phrase, shots rang out, as their passive voice to help acquit the cop in this murder. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. If this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. and they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Robertson at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Our first guest up today is Michael Schwartz, regular at tomdispatch.com. He teaches sociology at Stony Brook University, and he's the author of Radical Protest and Social Structure and the Power Structure of American Business. And then he also wrote the book War Without End, focused on oil and Iraq. And here he is at Tom Dispatch. Israel, Gaza, and energy wars in the Middle East. Welcome back to the show, Michael. How are you doing?
Good. Really terrific. Glad to be here.
Good to have you back on the show. Apologies if you can hear chainsaws and men talking in the background. There's a construction site going on next door, and that might just be a part of this interview. But that's okay by me, but just letting you know so you're not taken by surprise. All right, so very important piece here. The great game in the Holy Land. You know, everybody, I don't mean to confuse you, but there's always two essays and two titles for everything at tomdispatch.com. The great game in the Holy Land, how Gaza natural gas became the epicenter of an international power struggle. So go ahead and take it from the beginning. Who discovered natural gas offshore Gaza, and when, and what's the deal?
Well, there were rumors about it. I don't know how far back it went into the 1980s. But, you know, the natural gas wasn't the resource that it is now. You know, it's become sort of the primo new resource. And so it wasn't really looked upon as some kind of great a great resource that people ought to compete over the way they already were over oil and been fighting for 70 or 80 years over oil, and especially in the Middle East. So when the Oslo Accords were signed, the gas offshore from Gaza was just allocated, the possible gas at that point, was just allocated to the new Palestinian Authority as sort of one of the concessions that Israel was making right at the time, you know, as part of their projected withdrawal of their occupation of all Palestinian lands. But then, you know, it took about 8 years or so for the Palestinians to get it together, and they brought in British gas, which is the British natural gas equivalent of the BP. It's a very large international gas company with all of the facilities of that. And they actually ascertained that there really was gas there, and they signed a contract that was going to have British gas extract it and market it and hand over 10% or thereabouts, 10% of the profits from this natural gas to the Palestinian Authority. Well, right at about that time, and now we've gotten up to 2000, the Israelis were starting to have a real energy problem. You know, they don't have very good relations with most of the places in the world that have oil. They don't have any of their own. They had a tiny bit of natural gas. And they're looking at this, and they're, of course, occupying Gaza. So they said, wait a minute here. You know, we've got to get our take. We've got to get our share of this. And this set off something that's been going on now for 15 years, which is the Israelis demanding that basically they get that gas. I mean, they had all different iterations of what they were demanding. But basically what they were saying is that the gas that's extracted by First British Gas, right, would be delivered to Israel, and that whatever share the Palestinians were going to get of the revenues would also be delivered to Israel, and that Israel would dole it out to the Palestinians.
And now what year are we talking about again here, Michael?
Well,
at this point in the story?
Well, the first deal was going to come down in 2000, and the Israelis, you know, were patrolling the waters that were going to be drilled, right? And they said, well, we're not going to allow this to happen because you're going to just take this gas, you're going to ship it over to Egypt. The Palestinians are going to get some of it. The Palestinians are going to get about $1 billion over the next few years out of it, and we don't want them to have any of that. The reasons they gave were that, first of all, they needed the gas. Palestinians, and so they wanted the gas to be delivered to them. And secondly, that they couldn't let the Palestinians have anything because of the money, because they would just use it to attack Israel. But of course, what they were really saying is that this is a resource that we've conquered, and we want to control it. And so we've gone sort of forward from then. There's been iterations of negotiations, and basically what the Israelis were willing to give the Palestinians was a claim on a certain proportion of the revenues, a claim on a certain proportion of the actual gas, but that Israel should be in control of both of these things and dole them out according to what they thought the Palestinians deserved. And the Palestinian Authority, which was established under the Oslo Accords back in the 90s, right, would never agree to that because they were already experiencing what the occupation looked like, and that meant that the Israelis would starve them of all these things. So they would always refuse this, and then the Israelis would say, okay, now nothing's going to happen. Well, the most important moment was in about 2007 when by now Tony Blair is the organizer and the negotiator on behalf of British Gas and behalf of Europe, actually. He's saying, okay, well, what we'll do is we'll take the revenues that are ultimately going to be delivered to the Palestinian Authority, and we'll send them to the Federal Reserve Bank in New York. And the Federal Reserve Bank in New York will dole out the money to the Palestinian Authority and make sure that it's not used for any kind of weaponry or anything that's going to hurt Israel. And Israel should be satisfied with this. But Israel said, absolutely not. We won't accept that. We think that, you know, they'll bamboozle the Federal Reserve of New York, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And so that collapsed. And it was at that point that the Israeli government decided, look, we're just going to unilaterally develop this gas if we can. But they had a big problem with that, which is that these gas facilities are incredibly vulnerable. And, you know, by that point, Hamas was involved in this, right? And Hamas had those rockets that, you know, the famous rockets that Israel says is threatening their existential existence. But those rockets, while they can't really threaten Israel in any serious way, they are capable of taking out any oil facility. And so they said, okay, we're going to have to get rid of the Hamas rockets before we just go ahead and exploit this oil, this gas. It's all gas. It's natural gas offshore. So that was when they instituted the boycott and the blockade of Gaza, mm-hmm. and put Gaza on what they called a diet, right?
Right, and now totally, so you're saying this is why Sharon pulled the settlers out and ended the occupation of Gaza, was so that he could put it under this blockade, and it was all about the gas.
Yeah, right. The idea was, look, we can't blockade our settlers, so we have to let them out.
So now we
start the blockade.
Mm-hmm. And as you say,
they were pretty open about it. You can find plenty of quotes saying the idea is we're going to have this Hamas driven out by the people, you know, this sort of collective punishment theory that's been used over and over again by big powers, right? They say, well, we'll collectively punish everybody, and they will simply expel the bad guys that we don't like, and then they'll just allow themselves to be subservient to whatever we want to do. But, of course, the blockade hasn't worked, and after the blockade didn't work for a while, they moved forward to a military solution to the problem, which was to excise Hamas from Gaza, but also to excise the rockets, which were the real power, the real threat. And that didn't work with Operation Cast Lead. The only thing that Operation Cast Lead involved was to inflict incredible collective punishment mm-hmm. on the Gazans, even worse than the blockade, which was bad enough. Right?
All right, now hold it right there. When we get back, y'all, we'll have more with Michael Schwartz, author of this great one for TomDispatch.com. You can also find it at antiwar.com under Tom's name, Israel, Gaza, and the Energy Wars. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. Talking about the Israelis stealing the Palestinians' natural gas with Michael Schwartz, author of War Without End. Boy, you're pretty safe with that title. I think I'll call it War Without End. Yeah. Go ahead and bet on that. All right, so the natural gas is offshore. And here's the very important point that I want to get to as you write it. This is what killed the Oslo Accords, which was the deal back at the beginning of the 1990s that, yes, we are going to move toward eventual Palestinian independence here. Once the Israelis found out that there's enough natural gas out there to steal, that to be worth stealing, that was when they decided, oh, you know what? Terrorism is preventing us from giving up a Palestinian state. It turns out we're just going to have to keep the people of Gaza under siege and take their gas by force. Not that their military solution, as you called it, I think with ironic quotes there, has achieved their goal of routing out Hamas. That they, I was going to ask you, did they deliberately put Hamas in power in 06? I guess that was an accident. I don't know. But
A couple of things on that. One is that, as soon as it became clear that there were important resources in what would become the Palestinian state that Israel wanted to capture for themselves, it wasn't just natural gas, of course, because there's all the land that they're taking on the West Bank.
And the water.
And the water that they've been taking from everybody, not just just the Palestinians, right? But as soon as that became imperative, then the Oslo Accords were doomed, because what they had to say was is that you can't have any sovereignty over your natural resources. We want the sovereignty over your natural resources. So the moment when they dinged the deal for the Gazan natural gas was them overtly expressing what had already become a policy. I think we see the visibility of that policy at that moment, but I think it really preceded it, because they were aware of other resources. This was the first gas resource, but now, of course, it's become much more magnified, because it turns out that Gazan natural gas is just the southernmost tip of this Levantine Basin natural gas, which goes all the way up to Cyprus and Syria, and a relatively small amount is in the Gazan waters. There's a huge amount in the eastern Mediterranean there, and of course Israel has designs. The moment it was discovered in 2010, there were rumors about that for many years also, but the USGS, the U.S. Geological Survey, affirmed the existence of this Levantine Basin gas in 2009, actually, but the news came out in 2010. Israel immediately said, we have sovereignty over all of it. And that instantly put them in conflict with four other countries, you know, Palestine, Syria, Lebanon, and Cyprus. And that brewing war has really taken on a huge huge place in this, because the Turks have become involved through their Cyprus interests, and they're making claims. They've signed contracts with the Turkish Cypriots to basically develop what looks like about 60% of that gas that they're claiming. The Russians have signed contracts with Syria and are negotiating another contract with Lebanon that would give them the right to develop the natural gas offshore from those two countries, which also constitutes about 60% of it. And both of them are building up their navies there. Both Turkey and Russia are building up their navies there Israel has been building up their navy since 2010 when they discovered this stuff because they feel like they need the navy in order to get the gas. And so what you're really developing is a kind of World War One situation in which there's this tremendous military buildup all around the territorial claims of these various now much larger powers, right? You know, before it was Israel and a bunch of little guys that they could beat up on. Now it's Israel, Turkey, and Russia, mm-hmm. all involved, and each with their ally inside the area. Israel, of course, is their they are inside the area, and the Palestinians have just signed an exploration contract with Gazprom, the Russian gas company, for to take that natural gas and now take it unilaterally themselves. But the latest of the Gazan wars, right, seems to have at least deterred Gazprom from beginning that exploration, because just as the Palestinians have always been able to maintain just enough of a military deterrent so that Israel can't, now Israel has a military deterrent to stop a Gazprom from mining the gas on behalf of the Palestinians. So it's all staying in the ground. I mean, there's a kind of, you know, every cloud has a silver lining, because as I say in the article, if they actually extracted 130 trillion cubic feet of natural gas from the eastern Mediterranean and pumped it into the atmosphere, that would be just the right amount to make sure that we never could reverse the climate change.
Worried about that, man. I want to see the people of Gaza paid and their society rebuilt after Israel smashed it over and over and over again. How about we'll ban the Israelis from burning all fossil fuels from now on, if you want to worry about that crap. But the people of Gaza deserve reparations for what they've suffered here.
I agree with you there. But I think the reparations should come from Israel and rather than come from the natural gas, you know.
Well, whatever. But still, I mean, I understand your point. But, you know, it seems important that, as you say, that the policy of keeping the Gazans specifically under siege here and scotching the whole deal toward a Palestinian state is all about stealing this gas. And then so that includes the siege, as you say in the article, to the deliberate stated policy of keeping the people of Gaza, which is a majority under 18, a majority minors, to keep them on a diet. Not starving, but hungry, then bombing the crap out of them every couple of years. This is all just about Grand Theft CH4. It's crazy.
But, you know, there's another element to this that I think is, in some ways, is even more ominous than this, is that back in 2004, Mubarak said that he might be willing to donate a piece of the Sinai Desert to the Palestinians, and then the Israelis could just drive them out of Gaza and various places on the West Bank and send them over there. That guy died right away because the world said you can't really be serious about this. But there's been a flurry in Israel in the last year of exactly that same proposal. Either news reports saying that that the new Egyptian government has renewed the offer, Or just parliamentarians and other highly visible leaders in Israel saying, this is what we have to do. We have to just drive the Gazans right out of the Gazan Strip and just annex it to Israel. And, you know, that kind of ethnic cleansing, which, of course, should be so familiar to us because it is precisely what the Europeans in North America did to the indigenous peoples, right? Just constantly relocating them as soon as there was some resource they wanted. This is now becoming a kind of current in the public debates around Israel as a way of, quote, solving their problem, right, which is to say to engage in, you know, a kind of systematic ethnic cleansing that would actually remove all the Gazans from the Gaza Strip and move them into some arid place in the middle of the desert where they could die off, you know, quietly. Of course, they won't die off quietly. They'll fight, but you know. So the Israelis are now bringing into the public debate an even more drastic and even more brutal and even more genocidal policy as a talking point. They haven't started to do it.
Normalizing the idea.
Yeah.
Getting it out there. So, yeah. And people look at a map, Sinai, that's just no man's land out there where Bedouins starve. Right. You know, there's nothing going on there. That's a fate worse than death for the people of Gaza at this point, who 80% of them are refugees from the rest of what's now called Israel, which is their home.
Right.
And as far as the Indian thing, I'm glad you brought up the thing about the Native Americans, because I hear Zionists using that as an excuse. But in fact, in this society, it's kind of a super majority, sorry about that kind of a thing now that it's too late. Where Americans have decided that, you know, geez, if we had a do-over, maybe we wouldn't have murdered them all. And of course, a lot of it was just disease, but still, the policies of the sectarian cleansing, the ethnic cleansing as they call it, of the American Indians is, you know, right there with slavery as the giant shame of our society. If people even knew that Indians still existed, we'd probably be better to them about it because of the way people feel about it. And yet, when it comes to Israel's policy, we're supposed to support what we all now agree is wrong when it's in, as you say, it's almost an exact copy of the policy.
Right. I think it's just a horrifying analogy because once you see the analogy, you say, oh my God, it's exactly the same, you know,
it's just
unbelievable. And it takes this whole situation in Israel and it removes it from this sort of high profile, God, these people hate each other on both sides and they all want to kill each other all the time. And so it's sort of fair that Israel just kills them, right? And puts it into this very mundane, almost banal evilness of you're just trying to, you know, steal people's land, property, resources, and you're using various kinds of reasons, calling them barbarians, as the excuse for slaughtering them in order to get their stuff, you know.
It's as simple as that.
And, you know, it's just another instance in the history of the world of this kind of, you know, genocidal activity. And that then it makes it even more sickening, you know, that it's not even exotic. It's just banal, you know.
Right. Well, yeah, no, and I think it's important. I appreciate you putting it that way because it does bring the argument right back down to earth. And now all of a sudden it's much easier to say, well, wait a minute, if this was Argentina and Chile or whatever other just, you know, uninvolved third-party countries or whatever, and we changed the circumstances, what if it was the Palestinians who'd won the last few wars and they had all the Jews rounded up in a giant concentration camp in the Gaza Strip? How might that look or whatever? You know, these kind of questions become easier when you bring the policy, the questions back to economics and politics here on Earth and take all the holy war out of it for a minute, you know?
Right. I think that's right. I like that phrase. Take the holy war out of it and just look at the mundane, really ugly, ugly underbelly reasons, you know?
Yep. All right. Well, listen, I already kept you over because I'm just horrible at abiding by these hard breaks, Michael, but they'll be able to hear the end of your interview on the archive later anyway. So I appreciate it very much.
Okay. It's great talking to you, Scott, as always. Yeah. Bye-bye.
All right, y'all, that's Michael Schwartz. He's at tomdispatch.com, and you can find him under Tom Englehart's name at antiwar.com as well. It's Israel, Gaza, and the Energy Wars in the Middle East. The book is War Without End, and we'll be right back with David Hardy in just a few. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Oh, man. The chainsaws are just going wild out back there. Oh, sorry, everybody. There's nothing I can do about it. Got workmen at the house next door. And there's going to be background noise during this interview, but it is what it is. I hope it's not too bad for you. This microphone's pretty good about that kind of thing, but I don't know. All right. Our next guest on the show today is David Hardy. And he is the author of the book, This Is Not an Assault, Penetrating the Web of Official Lies Regarding the Waco Incident. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, David?
Oh, pretty good. Thank you.
Appreciate you joining us on the show. Hey, looks like the chainsaws have stopped. Maybe it's lunch break. I don't know. I shouldn't have said that. I don't want to jinx it. All right. Anyway, so listen, Michael McNulty has died. Who was Michael McNulty, David?
Mike was probably the man most responsible for reopening the whole Waco investigation in an official sense. He was a filmmaker from Colorado. He was producer of a film, Waco, The Rules of Engagement, and later directed two more films on Waco that I recall. Anyway, he became extremely interested in Waco and engaged in a number of investigations spread over years. And one of the most critical ones was that he convinced the federal prosecutor, a prosecutor of the Davidians, to let him into a warehouse that was unknown until that point outside of the government. There was an entire warehouse full of evidence. And in it, he found evidence that burned out pyrotechnic gas grenades. There are two, basically pyrotechnic and non-pyrotechnic tear gas projectiles. And the non-pyrotechnic ones are designed for use against buildings. The pyrotechnic ones are not, because they'll start fires. They burn a gunpowder-like mixture to shoot the tear gas dust into the air. And they can set things on fire if they wind up, you know, wedged up against something that's flammable. So on the packages, it says, do not use against buildings. Well, he found some burned out in there. Somebody had been shooting pyrotechnic tear gas that day into the Davidian house. So that was an absolutely critical discovery. And it played a role in the subsequent appointment of a special prosecutor, which didn't yield much results, but it at least kept the investigations alive. So that was Mike's role, summed up very briefly, a role that extended over many years.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, so there's a lot to get back to there, but we got a little bit of time. But if you could, can you tell me about your history with him, how you met him, and do you know the story of how it was that Mike became interested in doing a documentary about the Waco massacre in the first place?
How he became interested, he once mentioned to me that it had something to do with his Mormon faith. He's Latter-day Saints, and that in the early history of that church, there were conflicts between them and local and eventually federal government aimed at destroying them or driving them out of the areas where they were. And he became sympathetic to the situation in Waco, which faced much the same, an attempt to destroy or drive out a religion that was out of mainstream at the time. And I first met him, I must have known him before this, and he once told me we'd met at a gun show, but I can't summon up any memory of that. I met him during the House of Representatives hearings on Waco in, I think it was 1995. He and his director, William Gazecki, had a camera crew there to film various witnesses. Actually, they were filming in a hotel room, but they were very good at laying out the camera, so it wasn't obvious. They had some congressmen in, and also a lot of the witnesses who testified came over and were filmed. And I remember he showed me a photograph, an aerial photograph taken of the Davidian place, Mount Carmel, while the armored vehicles were assaulting it, where they had basically at that point destroyed the portion at the back called with the gym. Mm-hmm. And he showed it to me and said, well, what do you see? Well, I'm very nearsighted, so I took off my glasses so I could focus down close. And I said, oh, you found a body. And he said, what body? And I said, well, why were you showing this to me? And he said, that big red splash at the back, I think it's blood. And I said, no, it's a red flannel lining of a coat. There's somebody down on the ground, face down, and his arm, his right arm, seems to be caught in the tracks of the tank. It must be backing up because his arm is being pulled up toward the sprocket. Mike looked at it with a magnifying glass and said, I've been looking at this for weeks, and it takes a blind man to tell me what's in it. Then he called for the autopsy of one of the Davidians, Jimmy Riddle. Jimmy Riddle was found dead with a bullet wound and his right arm traumatically amputated, the right arm never being found. And the evidence was that, well, the photograph of the body in place showed that its clothing was only slightly singed, but it was inside the building, which meant that the wooden floor would have burned underneath it, and the whole building collapsed on it, but clothing only slightly singed. It was fairly obvious the body, he died outside the building, and after the fire died down, his body was laid back inside.
Yeah.
And that was critical because one of Mike's theories was that the there had been shooting from the government positions on the last day of the siege, the day of the fire. So it was rather interesting discovery.
Yeah.
note from those days, Gusecki told me that he filmed in Hollywood, so he was accustomed to dealing with big egos. And then he said, but the ones here in Washington make those look like nothing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's real power over there on the East Coast. So I want to mention here, if people go to scotthorton.org/documentaries, and I guess you got to go to page 2 or 3 to find them. I got quite a few there for you, but you can find YouTubes of all three of these movies now. It's Waco, The Rules of Engagement, Waco, A New Revelation, and then the third one is called The FLIR Project. And The FLIR Project, it's only, that one's not really a documentary film as much as it's a 30-minute beyond a shadow of a doubt kind of proof of what you see in the most controversial aspects of the first two, which is what you were just referring to there, David, the federal agents shooting people at the back of the house. And it's a refutation of that 1999 investigation by Senator John Danforth, the former Senator Danforth that you mentioned there, and shows how that was really nothing but obstruction of justice. That was an absolute, you know, contrived. They set up a test to mimic the conditions, only they deliberately set up the test to fail in the most obvious way. And McNulty definitely showed that in the FLIR project. And just briefly, what they had done was they sprayed water all over the ground to keep all the dust down. They gave the guys in the test rifles with extra long barrels to suppress the flash, and also gave them flash suppressant ammunition. And then they, and there were a couple other things wrong with the discrepancy, used the wrong cameras, and then they said, okay, action. Now let's see if we can replicate exactly what we see in the FLIR footage from the day of the fire. And of course, it doesn't replicate it at all because they set it up to fail. And then that was their excuse, that there was no gunfire at all, they claimed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I remember all that stuff. You know, there was another FLIR, which I should explain, infrared imaging, forward-looking infrared. There was another analyst hired by the Government House Committee on Government Reform, Carlos Gigliotti. And he was a real expert in the field. And he went over it and said, yes, those are gunshots from the government positions.
Right. Dr. Edward Allard, too, who had helped invent it, is shown in the films talking about it as well. I'm sorry to interrupt right there, but we got to take this break. Mm-hmm. But when we get back, y'all, we'll talk more with David Hardy about the late, just recently died, Mike McNulty and his heroic work on the Waco massacre. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you can hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples, and email me scott@scotthorton.org for more information. See you there. In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. The entire process, from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people. The first of these great workshops is in Orlando, Saturday, March 7th. It's just $25. For more information, go to taxpayersunited.org/govpensions. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, talking with David Hardy about Mike McNulty. And from reading Bovard and from reading this New York Times piece that you sent along here, I'm only just recently learning how much of a role you played in helping Mike McNulty get all this information that ended up in the movie. And I'm sorry I haven't read your book. I don't think I even knew about it from back when I was reading Waco books, and I've read quite a few.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
But anyway, so thanks for that. You want to talk about how it was you guys worked together, especially, I guess, on the second one to get the real proof nailed down in Waco, A New Revelation, right?
Yeah. Well, we had worked pretty well. My skill is I was an attorney. So from my standpoint, bringing a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit was, well, you're out of pocket the filing fee. And that's it. From there on, you can do the work yourself. And also, I'd been a government employee. I was a GS-14, and so I handled the Freedom of Information Act from the other side. So I knew it from both ends. Mike, on the other hand, was a great investigator. And so he would dig up something, come back to me, and go, can we get this? And I'd take off on the legal end, and when I got it, I'd send it to him because he was doing all the investigation. Probably the best example of that was, in fact, the warehouse full of evidence. I started in with a Freedom of Info request to Department of Justice. Department of Justice responded, we don't know anything about that warehouse. It's presumably under the jurisdiction of the Texas Rangers who collected the evidence. So I sent a request to the Texas Rangers. And they responded, no, that's not the case. When we picked it up, we were acting as deputized federal officials, so it actually does belong to the Department of Justice. So then I packed that up and sent it to the Department of Justice and said, apparently you do own it. And they wrote back and said, federal marshals. So I wrote the federal marshals. And they said, no, Texas has it. Well, by the time we got all of that together, it was obvious there was this whole warehouse full of evidence, and the federal and state agencies were passing it back and forth. And let's see, now someone, Bob, a friend of mine in Texas, friend of ours in Texas, Bob Bear, got to another shooter. They were at a shooting match, and he told what was going on, and the shooter knew... I don't remember his name.
Now, this Bob Barrett, not the former CIA officer on CNN all the time.
No,
okay.
No.
Just making sure there.
He's a Texas oil explorer and that sort of thing. Anyway, Bob Barrett's friend got to a Texas official whose name slips my mind at the moment, but he knew the head of the Texas Department of Public Safety, who was over the head of the Rangers. And so that guy broke the story open at that point, that there were some serious problems here. And I think he talked to the judge in the civil case where the Davidians were suing and said, essentially, we have an entire warehouse full of evidence that no one has seen before. So that was how we related on one level. And Mike, in turn, did get into the warehouse himself, taking the direct route, but we wanted access to the stuff where we could actually make copies of it and that sort of thing. But that was it. It took, I think it was 3 years of Freedom of Information Act requests and lawsuits before we had something approaching the real thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's just such a great advertisement for activism in general. If people don't do the work, it doesn't get done. That sure. evidence was just going to sit there if it hadn't have been for you and him doing what you did. So, you know, I hope people are picking up on that lesson there. It's a very important one. And I want to get back to what you were saying about the pyrotechnic rounds, because as part of that same cover-up, you know, reinvestigation, so-called, in 1999, aside from the faking of the test of replicating the machine gun fire, they also... I think, latched on to a few incendiary rounds that had been fired earlier in the morning. And there was one that was a picture of one that had landed in a puddle of water, or at least at some point a puddle of water was created around it, maybe. But anyway, and they said, yes, we did fire a few incendiary rounds, but that was way before the fire, and none of it was at the origins of the fire, none of the ones fired, and they had the records apparently to prove it. And so, okay, big deal. And yet that was an entire red herring, because as you're talking about what you guys found, what Mike found at the DPS evidence room, the Rangers evidence room, were these pyrotechnic rounds that delivered tear gas that were not the more sophisticated military incendiary rounds, but could still light a house full of children on fire, all right, and that those three were all found at the origins of the fires.
Yeah, and the clues were out there because... when they testified before the House, the Davidian Clive Doyle talked about the incoming tear gas rounds and how they landed under furniture, and he could hear them hissing. Well, only pyrotechnic rounds hiss. The other type do not. And he suggested that they throw them out of the building, and one guy said they're too hot to pick up. Again, that's only true of a pyrotechnic round. So there was direct evidence, and... Clive didn't even know what he was saying at the time. He didn't understand the difference. But clearly, pyrotechnic rounds were getting inside the building.
And it just goes to show how cynical these people are with their ridiculous lying cover-up, as though we can't tell the difference between the rounds. Because remember now, everybody, in the chronology here, McNulty found the pyrotechnic rounds, and then they said, oh, look, everybody, incendiary rounds. After we already knew that's not what the claim was in the first place, and they pretended that that debunked it. So John Danforth is just simply a despicable liar. It's a scientific fact, and there's no way around it, that he was lying and he knew he was lying.
Well, what really hacked me off about the Danforth investigation more than anything else, they only took action against one federal employee. They prosecuted him. And you know who that was? Bill Johnson, the Davidian prosecutor who let Mike into the warehouse.
Yeah.
They drummed up a charge against him of perjury or something like that because he left one page off one document. Everybody else in that case, some of whom committed serious perjury and provable on paper, they said, oh, well, mistakes were made.
Yeah.
So the only guy they went for was the only honest man in the bunch.
Yep, of course. All right. Well, again, back to McNulty. We're out of time here, but I'll let you have the last word about the honor of Mike McNulty and the great work that he did here.
I join with everybody else who describes him to simply say he was a great patriot. I mean, this man broke the Waco case open, and he did it working usually at his own expense over a period of 5 or 10 years. I mean, he just would not stop. And without him... that investigation would never have been reopened, and we'd never know three-quarters of the things we now know about Waco.
All right. Thank you so much, David. Appreciate
it. Okay. Yeah.
All right, y'all. That's David Hardy. This Is Not an Assault is his book. And tomorrow's the anniversary of the raid, 22 years. So go watch Waco, The Rules of Engagement, etc., please. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast Peace Talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show, et cetera, et cetera. Next up is our friend Phil Giraldi. He formerly of the CIA and the DIA, and now executive director of the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. And he also writes for the American conservative magazine, UNS.com. And, wow, this one is in the Hill. Great, Phil. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
I'm fine, Scott. How about you?
I'm doing real good. Appreciate you joining us. And so, the big excitement to me is that apparently, and I don't want to jinx it, so all jinxes are off, but apparently Netanyahu is too deep. Now he cannot call off this speech. He's coming to town to give this speech, and I am just absolutely thrilled for all the reasons that most of his critics are upset. They're saying he's jeopardizing America's relationship with Israel. And so, you know, three cheers. That's what I think. But so I wonder, what is your take? What is the take of the Council for the National Interest on Netanyahu and his upcoming speech in Washington, D.C. here?
Well, I mean, the Council for the National Interest believes that the relationship with Israel is wrong anyway, that it's far too one-sided in Israel's favor, and it basically has created a situation where the United States is hated by everyone else in that part of the world. So it's we want to see more balance, obviously, in the relationship. And I, like you, think that Netanyahu has finally gone more than a step too far. And he has a lot of people angry at him. And I think that this could be the moment of truth when people began to realize that the Israel-American relationship is a tremendous detriment for our country.
Yeah, I was amazed. Apparently this article came out on February the 2nd, it's Mark Perry, who I believe spoke at the conference that you guys put on a year ago about questioning this special relationship, formerly of foreign policy. And it's this article in Al Jazeera, Netanyahu's Congress invitation raises eyebrows among some U.S. generals, and eyebrows is understating it, I think. Got some pretty serious responses from some American military officers of the highest rank here. No wonder Netanyahu's friends of Israel who are criticizing Netanyahu are concerned that there are going to be some long-term consequences from this. In fact, one of them puts it in terms of, you're asking me to choose you over my commander-in-chief? Not
exactly.
Ever. Not ever. Yeah. Wow, that's pretty strong language kind of a thing. That's the way they framed it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I read the article, you sent it over to me, and it's absolutely astonishing. I mean, they're basically saying that he's attacking our whole system of government. And, of course, they're right. Some of them kind of soft-shoot it a little bit, said, oh, yeah, well, you know, I'm still a great friend of Israel and so on and so forth. But the reality is, and everybody in Washington who is not totally partisan on the issue understands that for a long time that Israel is a client state that has created more problems for us than has given us any benefit. And this is finally kind of coming to the fore, and it's long overdue.
Mm. Well, I can't wait for the speech. I hope it's a disaster, and I don't know, maybe it'll go off pretty well or something. I know Congress likes him. It's a pretty nice audience to have, but I guess really it's sort of bringing this up in a way that I think most Americans never hear. I mean, I think about, you know, what it was I knew before I started really paying close attention to stuff, and I have to go back a ways, I guess, but I think most Americans, they never hear of any daylight between America and Israel. They don't know much about Israel, but as far as they're concerned, they're a friend of ours and whatever, whatever. So for there to be a real contradiction between what the government of America is doing in its international relations and what the Israelis want, and that the Israelis are willing to go this far to try to obstruct, I think we'll, you know, hopefully it'll get a lot of attention. Seems like it already is, kind of bringing the question of Israel up to Americans who've never even really considered the question before. They didn't even know it was an issue before.
Yeah, and of course the other side story that's interesting is what's going to happen in Israel. Obviously Netanyahu has made a serious number of enemies as a result of this. People who see it just the way we've been discussing it, that you know, Israel needs the United States a whole hell of a lot more than the United States needs Israel, and Netanyahu has successfully poisoned the relationship. So he might lose the election, and we might be seeing some politicians who, by and large, will embrace the same policies he does, but they might be people that are better at talking with the Palestinians. They might be people who see the real politic situation for Israel in a much clearer way.
Mm-hmm. And now, as far as the fight over Iran here, I know you pay such close attention to this issue. But there's a major missing piece in this whole thing that I can't seem to nail down anywhere, which is, what is it that Netanyahu or the War Party, the Republicans especially, who agree with him on all of this, what is it that they want instead? Because when they claim any deal that allows for any civilian nuclear program in Iran is a bad deal and a non-starter, and they'll settle for nothing less than Iran completely abandoning their nuclear program, that's completely ridiculous. In fact, J.J. Goldberg has a thing in the Forward today saying that, wait a minute, they're so apocalyptic and crazy, they're willing to try to make one nuke just to lob it at Israel and get their entire nation blown off the face of the earth with our H-bombs, and yet you also think they'll bow to our economic pressure or these sanctions and eventually just entirely abandon this program. It makes no sense. And now somebody on that side of the argument has to have some kind of argument that of a different future than make this deal where we're expanding the inspections beyond reason, and there's plenty of reason to be reassured, and that's as good as we can get.
Yeah, and essentially that's what the White House is saying, although they're not saying it quite in those terms. But the fact is that these people that are like David Brooks came out again today. We had Krauthammer in the Washington Post yesterday, or was it today? The fact is, they don't want to deal with Iran on any terms. They want the United States to attack Iran and to eliminate Iran as a regional competitor for Israel in a military sense. That's what they want. And they're not going to verbalize it that way, but that's precisely what they want.
Yet, but they know, Phil, that they can't have that unless the Iranians really try to start making nukes, which they're not doing. So it's just more Cold War is all that they're getting instead, right?
Well, you know, I think there are expectations that they could have manipulated the U.S. into doing something that stupid. We're not that misplaced. Look back the last 3 years with Netanyahu coming for these annual visits and trying each time to set up a red line or a tripwire that would obligate the United States to go to war with Iran. And there's still legislation sitting in Congress, I'm sure you're aware of, in both the House and the Senate, that has that kind of language in it, that if Israel is militarily threatened by Iran, the United States will go to war against Iran. There's all that kind of craziness floating around. So I suspect that they felt they had a really good shot at getting the United States to take Iran out of the game.
Yeah. Well, and which would require, I guess they're still only talking in their wildest fantasies about an air war, right? But what kind of air war would it take to completely erase Iran's nuclear program? And in fact, to even, of course, job one would be to take out any, you know, military resistance that they could possibly bring to bear so that they can do the rest of the bombing. And that's a pretty damn big war they're calling for.
Yeah, it would certainly be. It would be a huge war because Iran geographically is four times bigger than Iraq. It's four times more populous. A lot of the sites, the military sites, are located in civilian areas. It would be an enormous job. It would take months to do this kind of thing. The Pentagon is aware of that. And that's why we're getting pushback from the generals. And essentially they're saying, you know, okay, we're allies with Israel in the war on terror. But, you know, it kind of limits when the limitation comes in when you're talking about starting World War III.
Yeah. Well, and also, of course, and I thought that this was important, too, as you mentioned, that just the process where I think one of these generals in the Perry article says, you know, I don't necessarily agree with Obama about Iran. but he's my president, not you, so shut up kind of thing. Like, at some point, rank counts, and he's the commander-in-chief, not Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister of a foreign country. Anyway, I'm sorry, we got to take this break. We'll be right back with Phil Giraldi. He's got a new one at the Hill, and we'll be talking about that right after this. Hey, all, Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is the show, The Scott Horton Show. Talking with Philip Giraldi from the Council for the National Interest in the American Conservative magazine here. Guess we probably won't have time to get to the NSA article. New NSA article at the American Conservative there. Hey, tell me, Phil, what is Busboys and Poets?
Busboys and Poets is a chain of... I don't know, bookstores combined with places where people gather and listen to speakers and listen to folk music and jazz. And that it's kind of a quirky institution in the Washington area. There are about five of them in Maryland and the District of Columbia. And I'm going to be speaking there on Monday night about AIPAC and about the Netanyahu visit. So
okay,
it's,
wait, it says Sunday in the email. Which is it?
It's Sunday.
Sunday.
Okay. Sunday at 7 p.m.
And which one is that on 5th Street here?
Where's 5th
that?
Street Northwest, yeah. If there, as I said, there are several of them, but that's the one. It's 5th Street Northwest, and there's also going to be Miko Peled, who's an Israeli peace activist, speaking, and we're going to be talking about Netanyahu and AIPAC.
Okay, great. And that's Sunday night at 7 o'clock, 1025 5th Street Northwest in Washington,
right.
D.C., for those of you unfortunate enough to live within driving distance of the center of evil on Earth, Washington, D.C. You can go see Phil there. That sounds like a lot of fun. I'd go if I lived anywhere nearby, but I don't. All right.
Okay.
Yeah, no, that's cool. All right, so, yeah, now back to the subject matter here and the question of the Israelis attempting to interfere in the Iran talks. It doesn't seem like it's working as far as – well, I don't know. What – Obama, okay, apparently is going to have a deal here, right? I mean, all trial balloons seem to indicate they're going to wrap this thing up in 6 weeks or so. But then, so what exactly could Netanyahu's Congress in Washington, D.C. do about that really to stop him, Phil?
Well, Scott McConnell had a piece on this a couple of days ago. You probably saw it. And he was speculating that in spite of all this, Netanyahu and the Israel lobby appear to have something like 60 senators in their pocket that will vote with them if the Senate passes a bill mandating that Congress approve any kind of agreement with Iran. So they still have a high potential to wreck this. Now, of course, they need more than that to be veto-proof with the president, and the president would undoubtedly veto them. But the fact is, this shows that how dangerous they still are. I mean, they're within reach of accomplishing this, and they would be able to throw a spanner in the works.
Yeah, well, I kind of actually would be in favor of that in a way, just for the crisis of it. You know, bring these issues to a head. Now, I guess I don't want to see it go that bad, but I'd like to see the nuclear deal go through. But of course, you know, the leaks already are that Khamenei and Obama both are saying that, yeah, we should work together against the Islamic State in Iraq, right back to George Bush's position of using the American Air Force, Army, Marine Corps as the auxiliary for the Bada Brigade.
Yeah, that's exactly right, and it makes sense. I mean, you know, I've been writing this for months now, saying that the two forces that are going to be most effective against fighting ISIS, if that's really your intention, since the Turks won't do anything, is going to be the Syrians and they're going to be the Iranians. And if we really want to defeat these guys, you don't have to get in bed with them, but you do have to work out some modus vivendi to destroy these people, and they should be destroyed.
Well, now, yeah, I don't want to ally with the Iranians at all, but sit back and at least recognize the reality that the Ayatollah and the Caliph are deadly enemies and that we could at least stay out of it, you know, at the very least.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we could use air power as appropriate. We could say, all right, we know what you guys are doing, and, you know, God bless, go right ahead. We don't have to enter into an alliance with these people. We don't have to embrace them as entities. We just have to say, look, this is in our interest, and it's in your interest.
All right, now, I want to get to this article in The Hill. U.S. legislation abused by foreign entities. What is lawfare, Phil?
Lawfare is the use of our legal system, or any legal system in general, to basically fight a war by other means. And what it essentially means in the modern context is that it is generally something that's carried out by Israel, although it is carried out by others too, but primarily by Israel, which has a quasi-independent part of its government that does this sort of thing. And what they do is they sue other entities in court to tie them up, to get their money, to basically punish them. And the latest case last week in New York involved several Israeli citizens suing in a New York court for an attack or a series of attacks that took place in Israel, and demanding compensation from the Palestinian Authority. And they won the case, and the damages could be as much as $1 billion, which would bankrupt the Palestinian Authority.
All right, and now, well, obviously quite a few issues raised here, but I wonder about the lawsuit abuse. Are there not judges who see it this way too, and aren't there already precedents from all kinds of different cases where courts can prevent people from bringing frivolous suits or suits that are intended to just harass rather than really accomplish their stated goal?
Yeah, you have to find a judge who's sympathetic, and certainly in New York City you will find them. And there have been a couple cases where the State Department has intervened in the case of Saudi Arabia back a couple years ago to tell the courts that this is not in our interest for diplomatic reasons and everything to pursue this. They didn't do that in the case of the Palestinian Authority. And so, you have to find a sympathetic judge. The people who engage in lawfare don't care if the suits are frivolous, because the idea is to tie the other guy up, make him get lawyers, make him do this, make him do that. And it's essentially what they're willing to do as part of the process.
Yeah. And now, so before we get to the suit against the PA that would really turn the West Bank, in effect, right over to the Israelis again, as you say here, can you talk about this previous case here and a little bit of a, you know, as kind of a explanation of how this works, this Sharat Hadin thing?
Well, I cite a couple of cases. I mean, there was one case that I found sort of bizarre, where they were going after the Chinese government for the Chinese National Bank having opened an account for Hamas. And none of this took place in the United States. None of this took place involving an American citizen. But they would nevertheless got quite far in the prosecution in terms of trying to get $1 billion out of the Bank of China. So this is essentially how it works. And there have been a whole lot of other cases.
By the way, on that one, was that effective? Did the Bank of China end up having to change their business and the way they dealt with Hamas at all?
Well, they had to close the account, that's for
sure.
But they,
oh, it worked,
they,
huh?
Yeah, so they didn't, but they didn't win any damages. But there are other cases in the United States where the lawfare is at work, where they're trying to shut down Palestinian groups at college campuses, and attempts to get BDS, you know, boycott, divestment, because what they're claiming is that Jewish students are having they're uncomfortable because of what the Palestinians are saying and doing, and people complaining about Israel, and so there are a number of lawsuits of that nature too in the United States, and that's all lawfare.
Mm-hmm. Well, And especially, it's just ridiculous to see the way this goes on college campuses, which were supposed to be bastions of free thought and debate and all of this stuff. And you know, those kind of suits, or at least the controversies that I'm familiar with, are all seem to be, you know, silly on their face. You know, I became scared when I saw a Palestinian flag. Well, the fear is in you. Sorry. There's nothing terroristic about a Palestinian flag, for crying out loud.
Yeah, it's that kind of stuff. But see, the idea is not necessarily to win. If the idea is to tie these other people up, make them spend money, or make them back off because they don't have the resources to contest this kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it's insidious. And these people who are doing this, it's all overseas. I mean, you know, apart from like this stuff at campuses, but all of the terrorist acts and everything that they're trying to get the big settlements from took place somewhere else. And very few of them involved American citizens or dual nationals in any way. So it's like our courts are being used to prosecute these cases, which are essentially political.
All right, but now, so if they win some kind of $600 million judgment against the Palestinian Authority, how is a court in America supposed to enforce that anyway?
They would go, if the Palestinians have any assets in the United States, they could seize them. And they could also seize the money that the Israelis have been withholding from the Palestinians since the Palestinians registered with the International Criminal Court.
Right.
That's about $400 million, I think, $450 million, I think, right now.
Right, the Israelis collect all
that
terrorists.
Money. Yeah, they would seize that money, and the Palestinian Authority would go out of business. There would be no schools, there would be no hospitals, there would be no anything. There would be no security services, so the Israelis would have to reoccupy the West Bank.
Wow, that's really something. I wonder whether politics would intervene at that point to try to prevent that from going through, or what would happen. I mean, it doesn't sound like the American government would want that to work, right?
I mean, there's no reason why the Israeli government wanted it to work.
Right.
The fact is, here you've created this Frankenstein that you figured out. Let's keep punishing them with lawfare. And not realizing that at the end of the road, you're hurting yourself.
Right.
But this is the typical mindset of people like Netanyahu, that the Palestinians are basically there to be punished. And if you can't punish them one way, you punish them another way.
Right.
And eventually, maybe they'll leave. I think that's the thinking.
Right. And then just like our previous guest, Michael Schwartz, was saying, it's all because they want to steal their natural gas. It's all for the most cynical of reasons. Oh, yeah, the Bible or something. Give me your natural gas or I'll kill you.
That's right.
All right. Hey, thanks very much, Phil. I kept you over time, but I really appreciate you coming on the show again.
Okay, Scott. Take care.
All right, y'all. That's Phil Giraldi, former CIA. Now he writes for the American Conservative Magazine and UNS.com, and he's the executive director of the Council for the National Interest. Go and see him talk at this bookstore, Busboys and Poets, Sunday at 7 on 5th Street in D.C.